Hello and welcome to PondJumpers, the international podcast for open source developers. This is episode 9, general discussion about the state of software development between Russ Miles and myself, recorded December 3rd, 2010. Hi, my name's Greg Turnquist from SpringSource.
And I'm Russ Miles from Open Credo.
And I believe this is, what's it been, like 6 months or something since we last chatted on PondJumpers, so we wanted to get together and talk about some various topics here.
Absolutely, shooting the breeze for a few minutes and talking about all things that we've encountered since last we spoke. It's been ages. What's been happening with you, Greg?
I switched over in January, and then I decided to move my family up to Tennessee because we got a lot of family up here. So it's about 12 hours north of where I used to live. So we moved up back at the end of April. That was one of my reasons for shopping around to find another job was my old company didn't have any offices up here, so I said, well, I'll see if I can get in, take a shot at Spring, see if I can get in there. But I looked for a whole year trying to find job spots, and they finally came back to me after I talked to them a year earlier, and said, oh, by the way, you want to work on TC Server?
TC Server is a big deal. I mean, that's fantastic news. So you're on the TC Server team. What's exciting in TC Server land at the moment? Because it doesn't get anywhere near enough press this side of the water.
Well, I'll tell you one thing is they've been doing a lot of changes. Like if you monitor the SpringSource blogs, they recently upgraded it. The Hyperic stuff. It runs on a. Used to run on a JBoss app server, and they replaced it to run on Tomcat.
Cool.
So
very cool.
You know, we have this plugin that is used to link Hyperic with TC Server, so that they can monitor metrics and things like that. That like Tomcat metrics and stuff show up in Hyperic, so they have this plugin to link the two together. And the every day, and I have to write code. It's like I have to go stop HQ. Deploy my changes and start them back up. So you're stopping and starting an app server, 10 or 15 times a day. It's the time factor, that's ridiculous. And then when they, to stop and start Tomcat, then, it's a huge ramp up in speed and productivity just to do that.
So you can do everything you need whilst it's running, look at what's going on inside there. That sounds, I mean, everyone at the moment I'm talking to, all the clients we deal with, the software developers are trying desperately to increase their tempo to software development. So, it's like you reduce the time it takes to deliver. So you say we're going to try and deliver something in a week, as opposed to 3 months. And suddenly everyone's looking at all of the little things that stop you being as productive as you could be. I think they call it lowering the waterline. So if you look at sort of a developer's normal cycle of working, if you don't actually have to deliver anything very frequently, then you sort of have a high waterline and you kind of accept delays on things. I mean, I'm not going to point any fingers at any particular app servers out there, but there's some that are associated with the color blue that take an awful long time to launch and do anything. And I've seen developers literally tweak parts of their app and then wait and wait and wait and keep waiting. And eventually this app comes up and they're okay. But because they're not under the sort of pressures for time of delivery that perhaps other environments are, and certainly agile environments encourage you to be in that sort of high tempo environment, that waterline is high, so they kind of accept that. That waste of time, that coffee moment, is kind of accepted. But then you go to another environment where you're seeing dramatically more productivity. The waterline is lowered. They are very much trying to deliver quickly but high quality. And so they need to still do all these things the way that they're used to doing it, but they look at any delay and say that is a waste of time, that's a massive waste, and it all completely adds up. And it also, I mean, there's a side effect here for how we think about problems, isn't there? I mean, when we attack a software development problem, we have in mind what we want to do, And then there's that jump, that hard work, if you like, the real thinking, to think how does that get expressed in the software. Anything that interrupts the flow of that jump is should be seen as almost, you know, developer enemy number one, because it's slowing you down, it's introducing cognitive overhead, your brain's getting a judder that flips it off the rails of what it was thinking about, and it gets then an opportunity to think about more important things as far as the brain's concerned, like what am I eating now.
Well, they one of the other big improvements is it used to be that this used to be the AMS product, which was sort of an add-on to that. Was before Spring acquired Hyperic. So now that they've pulled Hyperic in-house, so that they've got all parts are in-house, they've been able to do some significant refactorings while migrating to Springifying the whole Hyperic product set that this cool. plugin's a piece of. They've added dependency injection, so now they basically gave us access to the container. So there used to be a massive chunks of code that I had to deal with that just were not candidates for automated testing.
Right.
He had all this EJB, right. He had all these EJB calls hardwired into the plugin, and now they've created a bootstrappable container, and Jennifer Hickey put in the right, put in very useful calls that we could grab it and insert mocks in lieu of the EJB calls. So now Fantastic. It's actually testable.
it sounds a little bit crazy for a SpringSource VMware product to suffer the same problems, if you like, as lots and lots of people in the industry have. Even though in many ways SpringSource rip and the products they've got represent the solutions that you can still have, and I know it's through acquisitions and everything else that goes on at companies that size, you can still find technology in many, many places today, and even in the backyard, if you like, of dependency injection central, where dependency injection is not being used enough, but it's great that they're now applying it in. So you're working in a distributed team now. If I can remember my time at SpringSource, we're all distributed around the world, and I was a consultant, which made it quite easy to be distributed, because by definition I was on client site. I had a team of consultants who, we had our lifeline, which was Skype pretty much, and mobile phones. For development activities where your entire day is driven by working with people that, but from what I understand it, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, are not in the same room. Now there's lots of press and lots of thought going on about how these teams perform and how they be productive in that environment, and lots of focus on what communication and what environmental tools could be used to improve how these things work. How are you working at the moment in your team, and how big is your team?
The TC server team that I work with is probably about half a dozen people, I'd say. We don't interact directly with the HQ team, but there's been cases where I had to contact somebody or whatever. But we're working with it's an agile process. We have daily stand-up meetings. Right now we're doing weekly sprints. So once a week we have a 1-hour meeting to plan the next week's activities. The guy I work with the most we're the two plugin developers. He's in Boulder, Colorado, so we're just 1 hour apart from each other. So we've had a lot of times where we could chat with each other through Skype, or if we need to, we've done phone calls over Skype, and sometimes we do screen sharing. So he can show me something or walk through stuff, and he's been able to bring me up to speed because he worked on this plugin code for about a year before I joined the team.
Right.
And
what sort of challenges
he's incredibly supportive, but he was incredibly supportive with that because when he started, he had little assistance on showing him where what was where in the code. So he was like, if you have any questions, call me. I'll answer if I can.
I've had that question sort of thing. So what sort of things have been a challenge for you? Because distributed working can be, certainly working from home in a distributed fashion can be a little tough on the mind. It can be tough on the... It's got massive advantages, don't get me wrong. I work a significant portion of my time from home. But I also find it has to be a balance. So I have an, you know, OpenCredo, I have an office in London that I go to relatively frequently now, not because I'm trying to run away from my wife and child or anything, but because actually, otherwise I start to get a bit stir crazy. I start to get a little bit weird. People who follow me on Twitter probably start to notice it. I get a bit odd after about 4 or 5 days sitting at home. But it sounds like that's your life. That's pretty much where you spend the majority of your time. You know, do you find any of it a challenge? Do you find that you have any little tips and tricks that you use to keep yourself sane, perhaps?
Well, one thing what I've had to adopt is that I work in sort of a queued up style. Like, I need to think, you know, well, I'm working on this task, but I hit a roadblock that I need somebody to answer, and the guy with the answer is over in the UK, you know, and it's late in the afternoon, so that person's unavailable. So what I need to do is fire off an email, or, you know, fire off an email to put it in this hopper, and I need to go work on something else until I can get an answer back.
Yeah, so there's always that natural delay to time zones. I mean, I see this a lot with agile teams that are distributed across time zones. It introduces a natural delay, and in many ways, that's the same sort of frustrating delay for an answer that could move you on. That can actually, you know, it's another manifestation of that waiting for the EJB container to get its act together, waiting for, you know, the web container to get its act together so that you can carry on with your work. I can understand that being, you know, a reasonable frustration. I also know that the people in SpringSource are very good at replying. So it's, you know, you get a response, which is fantastic usually. So that it's not as bad as it could be, right? But so what about working from home? I mean, I know you've got a young family yourself, and you're, in many ways, working from home is a perfect, has so many attractive qualities when you've got a young family. It also can be the biggest challenge when you've got a young family, because kids don't understand that you're working now.
It's got its challenges and its benefits, and I would find it hard if this was my first job to work in this environment, because I'd feel like, you know, I didn't have any, you know, I think you need experience and discipline to be able to, you need to be able to say, hey, I need to go work on this for, you know, I need to go heads down and not be interrupted for an hour or something, or I need to go upstairs to my office, or, you know, and I need to focus on this. And there's other times when it's like, I need to tell my coworkers, hey, you know, we've been chatting on Skype for an hour, but I need to go take care of, do something with my family. Can we pick this up in an hour or two? And, you know, usually the people that I'm chatting with they're understanding, because that's what they're doing too. So
yeah, absolutely. You know, it's tough though.
As long as I can show that I'm really getting throughput, you know, I feel like I'm satisfying my team's needs, my manager's needs, you know, as long as I'm keep delivering.
Yeah, absolutely. But it is I actually find that one of the toughest things is the walking, is calling it a day. So I got some really great tips once from Arjen Pootsma, one of the SpringSource guys, a top guy, one of my favorite people to meet up with, have a beer, and watch him talk about anything on Spring. The inventor of the Pootsma principle, I think, which is a fantastic idea, is if Arjen doesn't understand what you're talking about, you're probably wrong. Which I've seen him use many times, and I've not caught him out yet, which is brilliant. But Arjen seems to, from what he tells me and what I've heard from other people, he has quite a disciplined approach to working from home. He works, you know, he starts work at a certain time, he works, and then he stops, and he has a break, and then he works again, and then he has a break. And that's quite, you know, that's, it sounds odd, but I found working from home, you know, tips for working from home, one of the biggest things I did was actually introduce that same rigor and say, okay, when it gets to 8:30 or 9 or whatever, I'm starting work. And that's something I tell my wife, something I tell my little girl, although I'm not sure she quite understands it. She has a habit of walking into my study and appears to be pulling CDs out of a shelf and then putting them back. I don't mind. She puts them back. It works for me. Between about 8:30 and midday, I'm at work. I'm doing stuff. I get focused. Then I take a break. Now, the thing for me, I don't know if you've had this, Greg, is that taking that break is one of the hardest times to do it. It's because you can be in flow then. And I find it very difficult to stick to eating, I think, is part of what you call it. It's actually coming away and saying, right, I'm going to go somewhere else now, eat some food, come back at a time, and work. And I speak to people who don't work from home, and they turn around and say, why the heck do you do these things? Why do you bother sticking to such rigor? I don't know if there's something deep in the human condition for this, but it's certainly something that I find I have to do. I don't know if you have the same sort of way of working, or whether you can deal with something a bit more flexible and chaotic. I found I've tried flexible and chaotic, and it's never worked for me. But I don't know. What do you do?
Well, I try to start at a certain time every day, and my goal is to finish at a certain time at the end of the day, you know. And there's times when I'm really getting into it. My wife's like, well, when you hit a stopping point, could you come help me with this? And so I'll say, okay, just one more thing.
Yeah.
Suddenly an hour later, she's like, I thought you said just one more thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So
that's it. And I think we should have a big shout out for our wives here, because bizarrely, I think anyone who doesn't work from home would say, oh, you know, your wives and your families must be the happiest people in the world. You know, you're at home all the time. You're on hand. Truth is, you're not. Truth is, these things intrude more on your life than they ever would do if you had an office job. Even if you're in the habit of working late in an office job, when you leave the office, there's a break. Something that says it's over now, and then it's your choice whether you continue or not. At home, I've found the biggest thing for me is getting at the end of the day and saying, no, I know people are online, I know I can talk to people and I want to, but no, now I'm not at work. And that took me ages to get my head around. I was absolutely lousy at it. I can see exactly where you're coming from. I've had that same scenario with Corinne, my wife, turning around and saying, could you just help me with this? By the time I actually get away from the machine to help her, she's done it. And I think she thinks I'm doing this on purpose. I can promise you, Corinne, if you're listening, I'm not doing any of that on purpose.
Well, and she's been pretty understanding when it's like, you know, we gotta go take our baby to the doctor, or do something like that, where I need to, you know, it ends up taking us 2 hours to go run some errands or something like that. She's real understanding that now I need to come back and work, and I'm gonna work for an extra 2 hours.
Yeah.
You know, at the end of the I'm gonna work 2 hours later, and that's been really, you know, she really understands that, and that's the kind of support that I need. But then what really throws everything a big curveball is at the end of the day, okay, I'm done with that. Now I need to go write.
Yeah, of course, because you've got a new book on the go. You've got your current book out, which is the Spring Python book from Packet, which I have my copy, so I'm very pleased with that. I know that I also owe you some editing technical runovers of your current book as well. In fact, I'm being quite aggressively chased by Packet at the moment for that, so I'll get to that straight after this call. So you've got our new book in the pipeline. Tell me a bit about that.
It's called Python Testing Cookbook. Apparently they Packet came out with a Python Testing Beginner's Guide earlier this year. They got a lot of great feedback from it, but part of their comments was more code, more samples, more examples of testing code. So they said, well, that smells like a cookbook. So they approached me and said, hey, you know, you wrote this other Python book. Are you willing to write a cookbook for us?
Fantastic. So what's your vision for the book? I mean, so, you know, are you going to talk about things like confidence and the fact you use testing to give yourself different levels of confidence from different perspectives? Or are you going to let that be something that bubbles up out of it by just focusing on the code? I say just, but, you know, focusing on the code and actually getting, you know, integration tests, unit tests, acceptance tests, all these different categories of tests and actually doing them.
It's a real get in and, you know, here's how to, and it's a real sampling of a lot of different test technologies. And I've tried to, on a chapter level, try to group them based on what kind of thing. Like the first chapter is about Pi unit, which is it's a unit that they dub Pi unit, which is it's their fundamental tool that comes with Python, which was based on JUnit. So it's, you know, a lot of different ways to, you know, where would you use automated testing, and you know, from how to get to your tests from the command line, or how to put together suites of tests. So it's a kind of a that's a real introductory type chapter. But then, and later, like I have another chapter that's totally dedicated to BDD testing. And
cool.
The thing is there are so many libraries out there in the Python community for doing automated testing that I kind of had to sift through and pick a handful of them. You know,
I
couldn't cover everything in this book.
Did you ask anyone their opinions on which ones to pick? I mean, there's always a danger in that because everyone's got a favorite, right? But did you go and canvas anyone, speak to them, and say, okay, you know, I'm going to talk about BDD. Which one's prominent, should we say, or which one's the preferred, or which one do I just really like?
Well, I did a lot of reading on, you know, I visited places like Stack Overflow, or I would search for things like BDD Python test tools, and I found a real detailed discussion on what people were recommending for it on Stack Overflow. So for BDD testing, you know, I've got some recipes that use the doc test module. You know, in Python, you're able to put documentation inside your code that's actually accessible from the REPL when you're fiddling around with Python code. You can put documentation, and the thing is, you can embed Python statements in there that are actually runnable through a test tool so you can have assertions built into your documentation. And people have recommended using that as a place to put BDD style testing.
Cool.
So,
cool.
You know, I've got recipes that show how to write some doc tests with a BDD flavor to it, but then I go the next step and show how to actually hook into the doc test module and customize it. If you want to extend this, and, you know, you can put comments into the doc test code, and so I created some doc test comments that, you know, would go and reformat the output report of doc test to make it look like a BDD output report.
Very cool. So moving up the stack, so you've got your unit integration test. BDD is a style of testing, in my opinion, anyway. It's something you can use a BDD approach regardless of the category of tests. Are you going to cover some of the more finicky areas, such as acceptance testing, performance testing? I sometimes call it soak testing. It's often putting an application in an environment where it's going to be hit like it would in the real world, and it's going to be, you know, it's almost going to be after 5 or 6, 7 days or whatever, once it's been hit enough times like it would be in the real world, we're going to look at it and just see what state this thing's in. So it's sort of like soak testing, but that's probably not the best phrase for it. Are you going to cover those areas?
Yeah, I've got a chapter that I call smoke and load testing.
Cool.
Smoke testing is where I want to switch on the system and make sure that nothing's burning, you know, and it tends to be like, you know, I don't want to run the whole test suite because the whole test suite's going to take forever, but I'd like to run a test that hits this part and that part and this other part, so it's sort of a cross cut.
Yeah, so it's basically, is there a pulse?
Yeah, but I also have some load testing, which this is something where I feel like I have a lot of experience from my career where my previous job, I supported a mission-critical system, and we had to write load test tools. And one of the tools that, you know, we built was we need to be able to record the live data stream that comes into the system and be able to replay it back. And we typically wanted to replay it back in two modes, either real-time. So if we record 24 hours of data, we want to play it back to the system over the next 24 hours just to see that our system is handling it.
Sure, sure.
Now, at the time that I built the tool, you know, I had to write special code to play it back that slowly. And then it just dawned on me, if I remove the delay, I could play it back that 24 hours of data as fast as possible, and that becomes a heavy load test. So
gotcha.
I have some recipes in the book to show how to go do that to your Python system.
Fantastic. I mean, actually, it's another verification of the smoke testing approach, actually, is this is something we've incorporated into our systems to try and avoid a very specific, embarrassing moment, I think, in the in your development of a project, which is where, so we're internally in Open Credo, we're an agile shop. We're on a journey of becoming more and more agile. We're constantly reevaluating the processes we apply. But one of the practices that we've seen yeah, save red faces, I think is the right phrase for it, is this smoke test concept of, you know, I'll give you an example. We've been working on an application. It's a complicated one. It's EJB based for political reasons, perhaps, and it's been deployed. And we've then got the time of the product owner and the business to look at this thing, right? So it's a big moment, and you can imagine it. The lights go down slightly. The business come in the room, and these are like gods to some people. And they approach the software, and the first thing they see is they literally press one button and nothing happens. And this is the moment you're trying to avoid. this is the moment of all hell breaking loose. And Jonas Partner, my co-founder in Open Credo, caught that moment and said, right, we're never having that moment, and introduced smoke tests such that whenever we build the software, part of the continuous integration is to deploy it. So we do continuous deployment to a representative environment, straight out of CI. And the very first thing it does is run some smoke tests, which are simply, can I log in? Can I do something with this system? You know, it's not about full regression. It's not, like you say, doing about massive test suites and taking hours. For me, it's that, is there a pulse there? If I show this to the business, am I going to avoid looking really stupid? And I think it's often missed, right? If you don't have a good CI strategy, you don't do continuous deployment, you don't have any of that baked into your process, then there's always that nerve-wracking moment where you're building things up to a demo and you almost have to do manual smoke testing at that approach. What we found is you can dramatically reduce all the overhead by baking in decent CI strategy, a really good continuous deployment strategy, not accepting that there are any manual steps in deployment, getting it onto a system and then running some smoke tests that are literally there to ping this thing and say, you know, it's the equivalent of you know, looking for something's pulse, and it's to stop it being embarrassing. I always like the idea of the story of it being the equivalent of being a sort of trainee doctor. And it's the equivalent of turning around to someone else and saying, I can't wake him up. And then finding out that someone just takes his pulse and said, well, he's dead. You know, it's that sort of level of embarrassment if you're presenting your software and the very first thing they see is a DOA. So anyway, that's just a slight deviation, but it's an important practice that has saved a lot of red faces here. And it's great to hear that your book's going to cover that particular area, because it's often missed. It's missed in the bigger story of load testing. It's you know, you're soaked, your long-term soak testing, your all these other integration, unit testing, acceptance testing, performance testing, all of this stuff that goes on. People seem to forget smoke testing and forget why it is such a red face saver.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned continuous integration, because I'm about to start writing the chapter about integrating with continuous integration systems, and one of the two CI servers that I'm going to write some recipes around happens to be Hudson. Have you been tracking the blogosphere or Twittersphere about what's happening with Hudson right now?
I have. Unfortunately, I've just got noticed that my baby's just woken up. give me five minutes if that's okay. Literally just five, and then we'll come back to Hudson if that's all right. Okay. Sorry about that. Looks like it was just a blip.
Lucky, good.
I've got one of those monitors. Do you have these? Sorry, slight deviation, right? But you got these baby monitors. Do you feel they're a little bit like torture techniques? You know, do you wonder if maybe they have these in Guantanamo, where they set them up like I do, right? So I've got a baby monitor that is it's not sensitive at all. It's at the lowest possible sensitivity setting because my daughter makes a lot of noise upstairs when she's sleeping. However, it only kicks in if she starts to yell, which means if you're sitting next to it, the moment she gets really upset, it comes through full blast.
Oh, you better not hang out at my house, because we play music up in a room all the time, so I can hear the monitor right now with music playing through it, and you know, I'm used to hearing the music all the time, and I'm like, oh, I go to sleep listening to the music too. But we had some friends come stay with us a couple weeks ago, and they were like, man, that music drove me crazy. It's like, huh, what? I didn't even think about that.
Nah, that's right. That's right. Actually, do you know, bizarrely, there's another software development analogy here, isn't there? There's the accepting weird things because that's just what happens. But anyway, yeah, that's what I've got here at the moment, is I've got the impending possibility of a screech coming in across the microphone, so I apologize if that happens. But anyway, we were talking about Hudson. And your chapter in your book on continuous integration.
I think I was tracking, and I read a lot of blogs, and I use Google News Reader to keep up with all these blogs, but something came out where apparently the Hudson developer community over the past few months they've been working on migrating their infrastructure off of Java.net, because apparently Java.net has been a fickle, unstable platform that people, they say about every few months, somebody's like, are we sticking with Java.net? It's a problem. Because so they were going to migrate things like ticketing, or I don't know, I think they were going to leave wiki support there or something, but they're going to move like ticketing, ticket tracking, and source code. They were looking at moving that to GitHub. So they're putting out the notice. They you know, as soon as somebody has an idea, they publish it to their Hudson developer mailing list. So the word is out, and I think about 3 days ago they were like to their last step of, okay, we're about ready to migrate the source code, and somebody posted on a group, on their Google group thread, it was a representative from Oracle saying, I think maybe we should keep it on java.net. and people were like, what's this? And he said, well, there's this huge Hudson community out there, and that's going to come across, you know, that's an unstable move, and we need to support them. And people are like, what are you talking about? Or what? We've been communicating with the community. And what it became was, is you had the developer community, which was vocal and communicating with each other, but then Oracle was referring to the user community, and they pointed out how there's a lot of non-vocal people from the user community that hadn't spoken a word or something, and Oracle was like, let's not do that quite yet. We're in the middle of upgrading Java.net to some new infrastructure.
Right.
I went and actually read the entire thread that they had there, because I was like, you know, I can smell an opinionated article when I read it, so I wanted to kind of get the whole perspective of it. And apparently Java.net servers was something that was set up by Sun Microsystems originally, and they actually outsourced it. It was like a third-party machine or something that they were paying somebody to provide. It wasn't, so that was part of its lack of stability. So what Oracle was saying is we've brought that, we're bringing that domain in-house, we're upgrading it to some up-to-date software, we're actually going to have resources allocated to it, you know. And so he's pleading, hey, work with us. If there's features that are missing, let us know, and we can work on it. And this is like after they've kind of, you know, migrated half the stuff out of there. They were ready to kind of flip the switch on it.
Oh, my goodness. So what's the outcome? Where are they going to go? What's the final thing?
I don't know where they're going to go. That's my conundrum. In fact, I wrote a blog. I have a blog for the book called Python Testing Cookbook.posters.com, and I wrote a blog entry about this where part of what popped up in the thread discussion was people were saying, wait, who's in charge of this infrastructure anyways? Shouldn't it be the developers who are at, you know, people were saying, how about the people that pick up the shovels and are doing the work? Shouldn't we have the last say in this? And the Oracle representative had communicated that, you know, we actually have the trademark on the name Hudson, so if you do move off of Java.net, we're going to consider that a fork of the project, so you can't take the name Hudson with you.
Right.
So that's kind of drawing a line in the sand. And so, you know, I'm kind of like, you know, I always encourage people, just go read the whole thread to make up your own opinion on whether or not you think it, you know, what you think should happen with this, or what's your opinion about whether or not they should fork. Some people are saying, fork now, run for your lives, get, just drop Hudson, I didn't like the name anyway, that kind of stuff. And other people are like, hey, let's not be hasty in this. So,
problem is, there's books out there called it. There's, you know, there's lots of investment in mindshare. I think that's that. I don't like that phrase, but it's something that's used a lot, isn't it? There's, you can imagine the Hudson mindshare being reasonably valuable stock.
So I'm not throwing out my opinion of whether or not they should fork or abandon the name Hudson or keep it. My issue is, whatever I write, you know, in the next 2 weeks, is it going to be, how applicable will it be when this goes to press next February?
Of course.
That's my concern about that. So I actually posted that blog entry last night, and this morning I woke up and somebody had put a comment on the blog saying, hey, don't worry about it. Hey, Pie Test Cookbook, don't worry about it. We're probably going to have this resolved in a few days. Or we're trying to get it done ASAP. So I was like, well, I didn't even know people from Hudson, which is, the irony is, Hudson is basically it's a WAR file that you run on a servlet container. So it's a Java tool for CI development, but, you know, I've got recipes on how to have it test your Python code.
Well, it's an application. It's a thing, whether it's running Java or not. It's a piece of functionality that's extremely useful to anyone who is serious about continuously testing their code base. You know, I think what we should do is actually, one of the things we should point out to the listeners is, if you want to keep up to date on this stuff, is we've got the Pond Jumpers Twitter account. That's PondJumpers. So if you go and follow Pond Jumpers on Twitter, then I'm sure that Greg and I will kick out the URLs to this blog entry and everything else that's going on, because that'd be fascinating reading.
Yeah, so I was surprised that somebody so quickly from, I don't know if they were necessarily from the Hudson community, but they sounded like they were from inside the community, spotted a blog on a Python test book. So I appreciated hearing that feedback so quickly.
Absolutely. That's fantastic. It's a very vibrant community. I mean, Hudson certainly seems to be a vibrant area. I mean, we've inside Open Credo, we've done some work where we've extended Hudson in a couple of ways that we're seriously considering pushing back into the community. The question mark is, are they generically really applicable, and can we do, you know, can we do these things justice? I mean, there's a big question whenever you're open sourcing anything. Can you contribute? It's not just a contribution, it's the, you know, are you then going to be around to take this forward, and if anyone else uses it, you're going to be around to help it. So that's a question we've got to actually come up with an answer for. But Hudson certainly seems to be getting an awfully large amount of traction. And I know that John Smart, who is someone I'm interviewing in a week's time, I think, once he gets back to New Zealand, John has written the book Java Power Tools for O'Reilly. Fantastic book. It is also one of the largest books in my collection, up there with The Lord of the Rings. But there's a lot of power tools out there. So John wrote this massive volume of great tips and tricks and tools for doing great things in Java. And one of the things that John delved into at that point in time, the book's a little out of date now, but he delved into Hudson, and I know he's now writing a book on Hudson, because he's been involved in some ongoing love affair with Hudson now for some time. They're starting to move into the married couple phase, and writing a book on it is that phase, I think, for technologists. So that's coming out soon, and I'll be talking to John about that book in the near future, which actually leads me on to something else. Some of the things I've been doing since last we spoke, Greg, is one of the things I'm doing is I'm creating a new podcast series. I'm still doing Pond Jumpers. I still want to keep doing this because I think it's fun, and I think Pond Jumpers is, you know, has a specific niche, right? We were talking about software development, very much focusing on the open source community. The other podcast series that I'm going to be doing is for my company, Open Credo, which is an opportunity for us to be a bit more vocal about the stuff that we're doing and the people that we're meeting as we do it. So what we're going to do there is videos, screencasts, anything that's related to if I can be so bold, software development in the real world. We're trying to look at, you know, talking to doers is the other phrase that we use internally. Is we're going to find people that are doing things and talk about what the, you know, success is and what lessons they've learned, and you know, they're, you know, let's call it what they are, the failures they may have encountered. So we're always looking for honest, no holds barred people who are, you know, able to turn around and say, no, this is what I do. I guess it's almost a kickback, actually. I don't know if you've encountered this, Greg. I've done a lot of agile consultancy, I suppose, to different levels in organizations, right up to board level now. And there's a lot of fluff in the industry around agile, in my opinion. And one of the things we're trying to do with the Open Credo cast is start talking to people in the agile space about real things that they've done. And that's a big key thing. It's not looking for somebody who says, I think this is a good way of doing things, or I'm always wary of that sort of phrase. It's, what have you done? What's the evidence for these things? And I think that should be good fun. It's going to be one of those things. I've already done an interview with a gentleman called Ari, who we're going to try and kick out the whole conversation in its entirety, although it might get an explicit mark on iTunes because... at times, it was late in the evening, and I've heard times we get quite passionate about some of the problems. And so Ari's, we talk about, I'm calling it at the moment, no rubbish agile. It's just talking about the things we do to be more agile in software development. And I think, you know, that's what certainly one of the missions of this new podcast series that I'm planning. At the same time, still working Open Credo and having a lot of fun with some great people, but I don't regret a thing. It's doing great, but the podcast series is quite exciting. Greg, are you ever coming over to the UK? Because I know that you've never been. Well, I've never known you when you're here.
Well, that would be an accurate statement. I did visit London one time a couple of years ago with my folks to take for a week's trip, so I had a fun time over there, but. Trying to think if that was before we met or not, but anyway, well, I don't know. That one point I've only had to travel one time since I joined SpringSource. We had a face-to-face team meeting in San Francisco back in February, but
nice.
One time they talked about having the whole TC server team work together for 2 weeks in the Southampton office, but really fell through, and when they figured out that too many people couldn't just. There were too many people that had kids and that kind of stuff that it was very impractical to get everybody to drop everything and go over there for 2 weeks.
So. Oh, that's fair enough. I totally understand that. The reason I mention it is that we've got a couple of communities that we're building now in London, and it'd be great to get you along and to speak at some of these communities. So we've got Agile London, which is... originally, I thought, you know, is this basically trying to turn the big city into a flexible environment? But actually, it's just purely about a guy called Joel and his desire to have people talk about the realities of doing agile software development. So it's very much in line with Open Credo and what we do. So we're supporting that, and that's taking a bit of my time up at the moment. That's good fun. And the other thing is, we are I'm doing QCon again next year, so I'm looking to be interviewing some people for Pond Jumpers and also the Open Credo cast podcast series. Meeting sort of great people that turn up at these the QCon London, and there's QCon San Francisco, and I believe there's a QCon somewhere in Asia as well now. These things are popping up all over the place. But I'm running the Enterprise Agile Transformation track on that event, which is going to be a lot of fun. Talk about a subject that's got issues. There's plenty of them.
I took a shot at getting onto the speakers list for the Spring 1 conference, or what they call it, Spring 2 GX conference that they had in Chicago this year, but my talk didn't make it in. There was a lot of submissions in-house, and they had to make a call at it, so I wasn't able to make that one. But one conference that I was able to go to. They have a local conference here in Nashville once a year called DevLink.
Sounds good.
It's really neat because the conference costs $100.
Oh, wow, good it's price really, level to get people
It's really
in.
Cheap, so That's I was good. Able to talk my manager into paying for that. But
from his spare change, surely. Managers get paid well.
I went to that, and it was really neat because when I got there, what I found out is it's a C#.NET oriented conference.
Wow. Okay.
So I was kind of like, you know, any conference is good to go to. So I really got a kick out of going there, and I don't know. At first, it felt like, am I going into enemy territory here as a Java developer? But you know, everyone's really was really receptive, and it was neat to see presentations on. You know, I kind of picked the ones that weren't, you know, hip deep in the technical aspects of C#, but instead they were talking about things like agile development, you know, cool. with .NET or something. So they're or behavior driven development or yeah. that. And I saw people demonstrate tools like you know, they've created a tool called MSpec, which is a derivative of the Ruby RSpec tool for writing testable specifications. So, you know, that was neat to go see that kind of presentation. And they also had an open spaces forum there. Nice. So I went and
I love that forum. We're organizing an event in January that's using open space approach, which I think is always great fun. I just see so many people getting really quality value out of doing open space, because you get this opportunity to talk about things that people really care about, rather than kind of stab in the dark approach of traditional events and conferences, where you know the speakers are in a strange game with the attendees trying to guess what they might be interested in. I love open spaces. They get to tell you. Sorry.
Well, I joined one of the sessions I went to that was really fun to be at was they were talking about different strategies for merging and branching and you know, what's your approach to that. And you know, everybody there except me was using the Microsoft tool suite, and I was like, well, I use Git, you know, which from what I understand is, you know, Git was built by the Linux community, and it's just, I don't believe it's heavily used on the Windows platform.
It's for a long time, its support on Windows was relatively immature, I think. So, I know we tried to use some. One of my directors is a Windows aficionado, and he was trying to access some of the code. We use Git internally as well, I can remember having fun with certificate generation and all manner of other stuff that actually comes extremely naturally on anything that's a Unix derivative or a Linux derivative. So yeah, it doesn't surprise me that that's a little bit fresh out there. But so you were talking about Git in a very heavily .NET.
They were talking about, you know, when do you do branches, and I was like, I do a branch for every feature, for every change that I'm gonna, every issue that I open up, I create a branch and then merge it back. And they were looking at me like, what? That's, you know, like, that's crazy talk. And what, you know, what we uncovered with that is because for Git and Git to make a branch takes about a millisecond, and you know, certain other tools, including the Microsoft products, you're really making a copy of everything, and it's very expensive, so they don't do it that way. If you've got a huge code base and it takes you forever to copy the code base, you're not going to branch unless it's, you know, really needed. And so I said, well, it's just, you know, it's easier for me to go ahead and branch and then merge, even if I could have done all the stuff on master, you know. So
cool. No, it is an interesting area, because I know people who work in .NET who are coming around to Git. I think Git is quite idiosyncratic. It's got a way of doing things, and it's extremely powerful. It's written by people that are very comfortable with command line. And I know there's been a lot of people who've put a lot of effort into making the command line as friendly and as self-correcting as possible. But let's not forget, this was created by Linux Torvalds, right? Linus Torvalds. Yeah, it's got an opinion.
Well, I think what's most unnerving to people about it is they basically, they have a lot of the same concepts that the other source code tools have, but they've just had, they use different command names for some of the same features you're used to. So I, listening to the Java Posse podcast, I remember them talking about revert. You know, in Subversion, revert means one thing, and Git, revert means something totally different.
Yeah, absolutely.
So when you're like, you know, if you come from a Subversion background and you're, you know, you're starting off in Git and you've screwed something up and you want to back it out, your first thought is, how do I do a Git revert? So you go look it up and you're like, what?
Yeah.
This doesn't make any sense. So trying to find the answer of how do I back out my changes, you know, once you figure it out, you're like, okay, I think I get that, but that was a bump I had to climb over that was, you know, if they had just made revert the right thing, I would have had this issue, you know?
Absolutely, absolutely. We've got a couple of guys internally that have, I think their first experience of Git was with Open Credo, and they've got some wonderful stories, which I'm hoping to capture in audio and video in the near future, of their sort of learning curves and the sort of pitfalls and traps, I think is the right phrase, of moving from something else like Subversion, Visual Source Safe, or any of the other tools out there, moving to Git, and you know, sort of distributed version control systems. In fact, I did catch Dan North did a talk in London. I think it was just last week at the BCS. It may even be this week, which I'm going to be looking out for a link to it, hoping people recorded it. And he did a talk on distributed version control systems as a sort of, I think the target was to introduce the concept without getting too hung up on one particular tool. But it does seem to be that DVCSs are getting an awful lot of traction out there at the moment. I mean, I know you use Git in Spring Source. I think there may, when I was there, there was a few Subversion hangers on that were gradually coming over. But it does seem to be winning out, the DVCS approach, for good reasons. I mean, what's your favorite features of a DVCS from your experience so far at Spring Source?
Well, to me, the branching and merging has been really powerful and effective. I've found that the way, you know, I can, you know, we've got multiple versions, and the way when you do checkouts, it checks it out in place. And, you know, I found it annoying with Subversion to have all these .svn folders sprinkled throughout the code base. So I like that's gone, and you do a checkout, and it's all in place, the version that you're looking at. And then it's like I can quickly, you know, jump back to the version if I need to do it, you know, branch off it, make my changes, and then I can then merge them in and then, you know, carry that on forward. It's been really a smooth thing. The one other feature I found incredibly powerful that I don't know is in anything like Subversion or some of these other tools, and I don't know about the other distributed ones, was Git Bisect. I don't know if you had to use that, but this is a case where I was working on the plugin code and something was wrong. So I was like, I got to go find out where the problem is, because I didn't know if it was something I did, something or something Bruce did, or what. So I forgot how I found Git Bisect, but you say, well, I'm gonna. The idea is you pick a bad point and a good point. So the idea is you try to check out and go back in time enough to where that's doing the right thing, and you tag it as that's good, and then you've tagged a bad version, and what it does is it automatically checks you out at the midpoint between those two. And the idea is you then go rebuild everything, check it out, and you figure out, is that a good or bad point?
Gotcha. So that's pretty cool. So
you then move the endpoints, and basically it's a detective tool. Yeah, it's a log two algorithm to track down which commit broke the system.
Yeah, it's a great detective tool to figure out where these things are. I mean, that's pretty cool.
At the time, we didn't have really any automated unit testing, so my testing was manual. So it was kind of an arduous process for me to track down. But you know, if you can pin it down to like it's between these 32 commits, you can figure it out in five hops where the problem is, and it's really, you know, that was really useful, because then I was able to pin down and say, aha, it wasn't me this time, so I can punt the issue to the guy that say you broke it.
Oh, come on, it's a no blame culture. No, that's fantastic. That's a lovely story about some of the features in Git. No, that's great stuff. Right, okay. Well, I think I'm going to have to call it there, I'm afraid. I've got a little baby girl upstairs who looks like she's going to be yelling anytime soon. So I'm staving off the inevitable at the moment. But what should we do in the future, Greg? What should we do next?
I don't know. This is I have to figure out what we're gonna do, and I want to split up where we do interviews and stuff. I can talk to you during the week because we're relatively flexible. But I want to do some interviews with my friend Matt, who's down in Florida, and he's really only available on the weekend to do stuff. So I think it's okay if it's probably easier to coordinate two rather than three people. So I may, from time to time, schedule stuff with him on the weekend.
Yeah, cool. No problems at all.
He's a real Ruby junkie.
Cool.
Like he's stuck in a Microsoft work environment, but
so. That sounds slightly frustrating.
he uses OpenBSD servers at home and stuff, and he even set up a website, one of the servers called commandlinehero.com.
Nice.
for people to post little recipes and stuff on command line tricks.
Very cool. Very cool.
Anything
that comes up, man, I'm trying to think in the open source domain what would be good to chat about. I mean, so for one thing, you know, it would obviously be good for me to introduce, possibly introduce you to Jonas Partner, who's my co-founder, because he's leading up the project on Open Credo Esper Extension, which is quite cool and interesting. It's a nice open source project that we could talk about. That would be quite cool. Because it sits on top of Spring Integration. It's glue between Spring Integration and Esper. So that might be kind of a cool subject for a future one. I don't know if you've encountered either of those things properly.
No, I haven't used them directly myself. I saw the Spring Integration presentation at the 2008 conference, and I said I could have used that, you know, 5 years earlier. That was something I was working on, and I was like, "It's too late. I could use that." I don't know much about the Asper system you're talking about, but I do know about Spring Integration.
Cool. Well, Esper's just a way of querying. So you've got all these events going off and messages going through, and Esper's a way of saying, "Okay, what I'm interested in is knowing in the last 10 minutes how many, you know, objects that look like this went through."
Okay.
So sort of temporal querying across an event-driven architecture is probably the technical phrase for it. But yeah, we could talk about that in a future series. That's a really cool conversation, particularly with Jonas, who lives and breathes this stuff.
The Pond Jumpers would like to thank the Skype call recorder team, who's made it easy to record Skype phone calls. Please send us any feedback or contact us about any potential interviews. We love talking about anything open source. Visit our webpage at pondjumpers.com or send us a message through our contact form or simply email us at contact@pondjumpers.com. All writings and recordings produced by Pond Jumpers are published through a Creative Commons license and copyrighted by Greg Turquist and Russ Miles. The content of this podcast and website does not represent any of the companies mentioned nor their opinions. The intro and exit music is the upbeat Roxxon, Sweet Romana, and purchased from opuz.com, the site for royalty-free production music.
Working from both sides of the pond, the Pond Jumpers are Greg Turnquist and Russ Miles.